For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week, Ursula Buchan takes us beyond the 39 steps to reveal the remarkable life of her grandfather, John Buchan.
From a very early age, he read books, he listened to ballads, he imbibed the Scottish heritage of literature.
Joanne Ramos asks, what price would you pay for a new life in her dazzling debut, The Farm?
Every move is monitored, and they're cut off from their daily lives as they dedicate themselves to carrying the perfect baby for someone else.
And we feature a new magazine dedicated to promoting inclusivity and diversity in children's literature. That's all coming up in today's Read On. John Buchan is known across the world as the author of The 39 Steps. Since its publication in 1915, the classic thriller has never been out of print, and it's inspired numerous other authors and adaptations for film, television, radio, and stage. Not least of which was the first adaptation by Alfred Hitchcock.
I returned from the city about 3 o'clock on that May afternoon, pretty well disgusted with life. I'd been 3 months in the old country and was fed up with it. If anyone had told me a year ago that I would have been feeling like that, I'd have laughed at him. But there was the fact. The weather made me liverish. The talk of the ordinary Englishman made me sick. I couldn't get enough exercise, and the amusements of London seemed as flat as soda water that's been standing in the sun. Richard Hannay, I kept telling myself, you've got into the wrong ditch, my friend, and you'd better climb out. It made me bite my lips to think of the plans I had been building up those last years in Bulawayo. I'd got my pile, not one of the big ones, but good enough for me, and I'd figured out all kinds of ways of enjoying myself. My father had brought me out from Scotland at the age of 6, and I'd never been home since, so England was a sort of Arabian Nights to me, and I counted on stopping there for the rest of my days. But from the first, I was disappointed with it. In about a week, I was tired of seeing sights, and in less than a month I'd had enough of restaurants and theatres and race meetings. I had no real pal to go about with, which probably explains things. Plenty of people invited me to their houses, but they didn't seem much interested in me. They would fling me a question or two about South Africa, and then get on to their own affairs. A lot of imperialist ladies asked me to tea to meet schoolmasters from New Zealand and editors from Vancouver, and that was the dismalest business of all.
Andrew Timothy narrating The 39 Steps by John Buchan, which is TB 897. Yet there was vastly more to JB, as he was known, than his success as a thriller writer. Beyond The 39 Steps, A Life of John Buchan is the new biography written by his granddaughter Ursula Buchan. With access to a family archive, much of which has never been published before, she has produced a fascinating portrait of a remarkable man. Ursula Buchan, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me here to talk.
It's a pleasure. John Buchan's is fundamentally a story of books. He was a rather bookish boy, and even at university he was writing reviews and fiction, wasn't he?
He certainly was, yes. He was the son of a Free Kirk minister in Scotland. They didn't have much money. They lived in poor industrial parishes, but there were always books in the house, and his father was a very educated, literate man who taught him to love Walter Scott and Robbie Burns, and he found Stevenson for himself. So from a very early age, he read books, he listened to ballads, he imbibed the Scottish heritage of literature.
And he married a rather bookish girl, and so began a rather touching love story.
Indeed, yes, yes. They weren't from the same sphere at all. She was English, she was Anglican, he was Presbyterian, of course, and she was aristocratic. But she was very fond of reading. It's how she spent her childhood. And after she married John Bracken, particularly after the First World War, she wrote histories and fiction and children's novels as well.
Are there records of them sitting down and enjoying books together, or did they have quite different tastes?
Oh, no, no, there definitely are. They lived in a house called Elsfield Manor after the First World War. They moved there in early 1920. And there, in the days before television and radio, really, they would sit in the evenings reading to each other. And John Bracken would often read a chapter or two of the book that he was working on at the time. And the children remember it is a very important thing, this reading out loud, both of good literature but also the novels that he wrote.
Well, John Bracken's books read so well as audiobooks. I think you can tell by listening to them that they must have been read out loud. And it's rather nice to think that your father, presumably...
Yes, indeed, yeah.
..would have listened to his father's fiction.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was remarkable how easy he found it to write his thrillers. He would go for a long walk and work on the plot in his head, come back, and even with his children playing around him, he would settle down and write his fiction. And the manuscripts, which are all in the Queen's University Archive in Kingston, Ontario, they show hardly any amendments or crossings out. It's quite amazing. He just sat down and wrote them at dictation speed, really.
And he began writing the 39 Steps just before the outbreak of the First World War, didn't he?
That's right. He was ill with a duodenal ulcer, which meant that he couldn't join up. He was 39 that summer, and he and his family went to Broadstairs for a holiday and for him to try to recuperate from this stomach pain. And while lying in bed, he'd run out of thrillers. He always enjoyed thrillers. So he decided to write his own. And he wrote it in 6 weeks.
Gosh. It obviously was hugely successful. And as with the sequels such as Greenmantle, there's a rather touching part in the book where you point out that the reason there are so few first editions with dust jackets of both those books is because so many of them were lost with the British troops on the Western Front.
That's the theory, and it seems a credible one. He was very, very popular with men in the trenches. The 39 Steps extends only to 254 pages in its first edition. You could read it possibly on a night watch, and it was fast-paced, and you were gripped on the first page. And it was about a chap trying to save the country's defence secrets. I mean, how appealing would that be to men stuck in the trenches?
He called it a shocker. Was he surprised by its success, do you think?
Yes, I think so. It sold 25,000 copies in the first 6 weeks, which was remarkable. And it was reviewed very kindly too. So it was after 39 Steps and then Greenmantle, which came out the following year in 1916, that he began to think that he could make proper money out of writing these books, which came to him so easily.
I thoroughly enjoyed reading Greenmantle when I was a teenager, and I've reread it recently. And one thing that really struck me is how close the character of Sandy Arbuthnot is to T.E. Lawrence. Your grandfather was working at the Ministry of Information as the director of propaganda, wasn't he, basically, during the First World War. Do you think he was influenced by the story of Lawrence?
Nobody knows whether they met during the First World War. They certainly met afterwards and they became very good friends. And I talk in the book about that friendship because it's quite crucial to Lawrence being able to join the RAF. He asked John Bracken to plead with Stanley Baldwin, and Baldwin then pleaded with Trenchard. So Lawrence moved from the Tank Corps to the Royal Air Force. So it was a crucial relationship. I don't think they met in the First World War, but it's possible that Lawrence had something to do with the fall of Erzurum, which fell very easily, which is the denouement of Greenmantle. But certainly after the war, in the 20s, they became good friends. And Lawrence went to visit him 10 days before he was killed in that motor bicycle accident in 1913. 35, I think it was. Unfortunately, John Buchan was in London, but my father remembered very well him arriving on a Brough motor bicycle and the smell of the oil as it growled down the street afterwards.
Now, your grandfather went on to write over 100 books, but as the title of your book says, it's beyond the 39 steps. He achieved so much more than simply being a novelist.
That's right. Because of his upbringing, which was hugely important, he always felt that he had to do good in the public square, really. And so after the First World War, well, in the 20s, he became an MP and did a number of years in the House of Commons. And then in 1935, he was appointed Governor General of Canada. And those 5 years in Canada were very, very important. His relationship with the Prime Minister and also his growing friendship with Roosevelt, President of the United States, was important for diplomacy, a lot of it rather undercover, but certainly diplomacy before the Second World War.
He was hugely well respected and, as your book makes very clear, hugely well liked.
He was. He was plainly a delightful man, a sparkling conversationalist, and very good to his friends, especially if they were in trouble. He was a good man. I mean, he had his faults. He could be vain. He lobbied for an honour after the First World War, which we find rather difficult now. He wasn't as good a businessman as he thought he was. He worked for many years in the publishing company Thomas Nelson & Sons, which had offices in Edinburgh and London, and he thought he was a better businessman than he was. And he was, before the First World War anyway, part of that entitled upper-class circle. Later on, he became much more ecumenical, as it were. So he had his faults, but generally speaking, he was much loved by an enormous circle of friends. He seemed to be able to get on with anybody, be they fur traders in the north of Canada or Roman Catholic French-Canadian priests or prime ministers, diplomats, the King and Queen. He organised and engineered a hugely important and, as it turned out, and very successful tour of Canada by the new King George VI and Queen Elizabeth, who we know as the Queen Mother, of course, in the summer of 1939, very soon before the start of the Second World War. And he could get on with them, but he could get on with anybody he met on his travels, impoverished farmers in the prairies, just everybody, really. And after he died, he was mourned most sincerely by an enormous range of people.
And he received a state funeral.
He did, yes. As Governor General, somebody who died while in office. He was only 64. He died in February 1940. He'd had a slight stroke and he fell and hit his head badly against the bath in his bathroom in the Governor General's residence in Ottawa. And he was rushed to Montreal on a train with the tracks cleared to let the train go past. And he was operated on several times in the Neurological Institute in Montreal by the world-famous surgeon, Dr. Wilder Penfield, but they couldn't save him. And so he lay in state in the Senate House in the Parliament buildings in Ottawa for 2 days, and then after a state funeral, his body was taken to Montreal, cremated, and secretly brought home to England on a ship called HMS Orion and buried in the churchyard of the village where he lived in Oxfordshire. And the editor of the Times said he had never received so many letters of regret from readers at the death of a public figure.
Quite an achievement for a son of the manse who was born into, well, not really those circles of society.
Absolutely not. No, really not. But he had a very rigorous education, such as was common to Scots in the late 19th century. He went to a school in the Gorbals, which in those days was a terrible slum in Glasgow, a school called Hutchison's Grammar School. So he didn't have an entitled childhood at all. In fact, far from it. But he was educated very well. And I think we're inclined too easily, really, to think that in those days, class hierarchies were absolutely adamantine. I don't think they were. They were more porous than we realise now. I'm sure there were people who sneered at him, who thought he was an upstart, a parvenu. But generally speaking, people in all walks of life, once they got to know him, they admired him and found him a distinguished figure.
And your book is based on quite a lot of documents that have never been seen or published before. Where did the new archive come from?
In a number of places, but certainly from the family. There were two very big archives of John Buchan's papers in public collections in the National Library of Scotland in Edinburgh and in Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, which is also where his library of 4,000 or so books are. But when it became known in the family that I was writing this biography, people found letters in cupboards. But also the grandchildren or great-grandchildren of some of the people who were very close to John Buchan also came forward, or I managed to find them. And so I have seen really quite a lot of archive that nobody else has seen before, which has been very helpful. Not only that, in the last, it's about 25 years since the last biography came out, a lot of academic work has been done on John Buchan, not just in British universities, but abroad as well. I'm a journalist, and my job really is to take a lot of information and try and turn it into a, hopefully, attractive narrative for what we call the general reader. And that is what I tried to do. I can't tell you how much information I acquired, but I had to try and make it into a readable narrative. I mean, my book is quite big, but it could have been a lot bigger.
And you clearly thoroughly enjoyed researching and writing it.
I did. I absolutely loved it. And though I have read much about him before, sitting down and reading basically his canon, not absolutely everything, but pretty well everything, and then thinking about him as a man, I found a fascinating process. And I'm so pleased that Bloomsbury felt it was worth publishing. And certainly the reaction to it has been extremely positive.
And hopefully there's going to be an audio version?
Yes, I've been told by Bloomsbury that they plan to bring out an audio version, which is great news, frankly. Because John Buchan, as you've said, has always been popular. His fiction has always been popular in audiobook or audio version form. But it would be very nice for people to be able to listen to this as well.
Well, I certainly can't wait. Do you have a favourite of his books?
I like the short stories enormously, and I wish they were better known. But I think probably amongst the fiction, his last novel, which is set in Canada, called Sick Heart River, I think that is my favourite.
I understand that you have some links to Sightloss yourself.
My father, John Buchan's second son, William, in his later years, he developed macular degeneration. And towards the end of his life, he was severely sight impaired. And I remember going once to see him in June, I think probably about a year before he died. And I am a very keen gardener, and so was he. I took some stems and flowers of a sweetbriar called Rosa rubiginosa greenmantle. It's named after a character in a Sir Walter Scott novel, but it's also, as I've said, a novel by John Buchan as well. And though he couldn't see it, I gave him the leaves to crush. And the thing about sweetbriar is that they give off a lovely apple scent when the leaves are crushed. So this scent sort of pervaded the room. And I'd also brought the flowers of a rose that he'd given me, a plant called Madame L'Oréal de Barny, which it was his favourite rose, and he'd given it to me because it was so scented. It was one of the old roses that he'd grown after the Second World War, before they were popular. And again, the scent filled the room, and it set off a whole chain of memories of gardens we'd visited, plants we liked, scents we liked. It was a very happy time, really.
Ursula Buchan, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Beyond the 39 Steps, A Life of John Buchan is out now in hardback and ebook, and let's hope that audio version is on its way soon. Ursula Buchan will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Silip, the Library and Information Association, launches a brand new magazine to promote diversity and inclusivity in children's literature. But first, The Farm is one of the most talked-about novels of 2019, an all-too-believable portrait of what the human fertility industry could become. It's both chillingly dystopian and caustically funny. The book has already drawn comparisons to Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale and to Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. That it's Ramos's debut novel is even more impressive. She was recently in London for the book's UK launch and found time to join me in the studio. Joanne Ramos, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
For those who haven't yet read the book, because it's only just come out, could you just give us a little bit of an outline of the plot?
Yes, I'd love to. So imagine you're in the most luxurious spa that you've ever seen. It's got everything. Gourmet meals, private massages, daily yoga. And it's all for free. In fact, the women who stay there get paid huge money. The only catch is that for the 9 months of their stay, they can't leave the grounds, every move is monitored, and they're cut off from their daily lives as they dedicate themselves to carrying the perfect baby for someone else. All the women at this spa are surrogates carrying the babies of the richest people in the world. And this is The Farm.
It's chillingly plausible. You start the book with a baby nurse, Arte, and her younger cousin, who's the hero of the book, Jane. And they are both baby nurses looking after babies until they're about 12 weeks old, getting them to sleep through the night. And you point out that successful Americans and Britons will outsource this part of childcare because it's too troublesome for them. It's too much hard work. And then we move to the farm and you suddenly realise that if childcare can be commoditised, so can childbearing. Where did the idea come from for you?
So it's funny, when I started writing the book, I was 40 and I had the themes that I wanted to tackle, inequality and otherness and motherhood, but I couldn't find a story that would fit until I happened upon a very short article in the Wall Street Journal, and it was about a surrogacy facility in India. So this industry has already been banned now, but at the time it was still ongoing there, and Westerners and others were hiring local Indian women to carry their babies. So that does exist out there.
Somehow, this very dark, dystopian book is actually also very funny as well. You clearly enjoyed writing it. It's got some very dark humour. I'm not going to give any spoilers, but you set up some of the downfall moments for Jane, the protagonist, especially, like some of the best written comedy I've ever read.
I do think that this zeal to give our children the best of everything, which characterizes my generation of parenting, when you couple that with enormous privilege and access, it can go ridiculous places. I don't know if you've heard here in the UK, but there is this major college admission scandal in the US where people were spending upwards of $500,000 to get their children into school by photoshopping pictures on pole vaulters and rowers, faking that these children were athletes when they didn't even play the sports. I mean, that's real life. Real life has gotten ridiculous. And it was pretty fun in my book to explore that.
And you explore that especially through the Filipino characters. There's the line that no immigrant has ever apologized for wanting to make themselves better, and that money is freedom in the United States. It's the freedom to buy anything. And I suppose it's the white American characters who are more embarrassed about admitting that than the immigrant characters.
I think that's true. I was born in the Philippines. We moved to Wisconsin when I was 6. And I was very much raised on the story and maybe the mythology of meritocracy. I was very much raised that if I worked really hard and I was savvy and I played by the rules, I would make it. And for me, that has come to pass. But there was a lot of luck involved even in that, because my parents were educated, because they figured out the public school system in my town. Flash forward 30 years when I am raising my children in New York City after a career in Wall Street, living a very different life than the middle class one in which I grew up. And I realized the only Filipinas I knew in my day-to-day orbit in Manhattan were baby nurses and housekeepers. And it really even reinforced more this question I've always had about how real is meritocracy when happenstance is equally, or I could argue more powerful as a determinant of your life.
I haven't finished the novel yet. I'm about three quarters of the way through, so please, no spoilers. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. It's keeping me turning the pages. I get the real sense that if there's an evil protagonist in the book, it's definitely the corruption that money causes, the corruption of people's morals and people's aspirations. You say you worked on Wall Street. Was that part of the impetus behind the book, just to show how corrupting money can be?
I was waiting for you to say the villain was Mayhew. That's what everyone says, and then I start to dispute it. But you're the only person who's ever said that to me, which is how I see the villain as capitalism run amok or the system. So anyway, thank you. I thought that was great.
You know, I went into Wall Street right after college because I had a lot of student debt. And honestly, I wanted to learn how the world worked and how making money worked. And I had a lot of difficult experiences there as one of the few women on Wall Street, and especially in my job afterwards in private equity. But I also had a lot of very great experiences. I think it's more my life now and seeing how much we outsource and how much, let me put it this way, I never understood how unfair the world was until I had money. I never knew growing up how many advantages the people who are on the other side of that divide when I was young had. And it's shocking to me, and it's really made me question even more the idea of the American dream and the possibility of it, given how unequal our society has become and how commodified so much of our life has become.
Definitely the surrogate mums and the babies are commodities, just like any derivative or whatever.
Yes.
I think what's so interesting about all the women who are the main characters in the book is that you dig deep into their motivations. They are 3D characters. Yes, they got their flaws, but you can see where their flaws have come from.
That's what I was trying to do. But really, I've done a lot of interviews. By this point, you're the first person to say the villain was the system or capitalism or the over-commodification of our lives and not Mayhew. And I think that's really interesting. I mean, that's the answer I would give.
Well, let's hope it gives people pause for thought. The book is being hailed as a dystopian novel. You're drawing some very, very favourable parallels with Margaret Atwood's book, The Handmaid's Tale, and also Brave New World. Do you see it as a dystopian novel?
Thank you for asking that. It's funny, I did not set out to write a dystopian novel. What I meant to do was write about where we are now, but pushed forward a few inches. And in fact, except for some of the technology that I made up in the book to sort of control the women at the farm, everything else is happening. The surrogacy facility that I made up, Golden Oaks, is a luxury one, so that is an amplification. But there are surrogacy facilities, there were at least in India, and I've read about them in Thailand and other places. Surrogacy exists. Outsourcing of parenthood exists. This whole world of Filipina and other women who leave their children behind in their homelands to take care of other people abroad so that they can support their families back home, that exists. And so is that dystopian? I guess the reader would have to question if she believes that we're living in a dystopia.
And the gap between the wonderful facilities that you've described at Golden Oaks, the perfect chef-prepared food, and its very name, and the reality of what the women who are bearing the babies become. There's a very, very powerful scene there where one of the characters, Reagan, is having her first ultrasound and the screen is turned away so that the biological mother who is watching via the internet can see what the baby looks like and have it described to her by the doctor. And Reagan is just lying there like a piece of meat on a slab, like a prize cow, really. There are some really chilling images in the book.
They're containers. That's what they are. Mayhew, who is the woman who runs Golden Oaks, has even set up a system of ranking the containers. She has hosts, which are the typical container to hold the baby. And then she has premium hosts who tend to be Caucasian, college educated at a prestigious school, because Mayhew has found that some parents will pay a lot more money to be able to brag about their surrogates. And that is based a little bit in some stories I've come across where people I've met do care about that.
You clearly are very widely read as well. Who do you see as the authors who have influenced you?
The first book that I loved as a child was Little Women because of Jo being a writer. But then the other writers that have really meant something to me as I was writing this book were Virginia Woolf, her writer's diary, also just her sort of stream of consciousness, I think informed a lot of Reagan, one of the premium hosts in my book.
And then I love Catherine Boo. I don't know if you've read her book, Beyond the Beautiful Forevers, but it's about India, a slum in India. And it's nonfiction. But I remember after reading it thinking I would love to write something that makes the unseen scene like that. I am not the journalist that she is, and so I turned to fiction instead. But I do hope that in some small way, the farm allows these women to be seen.
It definitely lifts the lid on something that we might otherwise not know about or choose not to know about.
Right.
Are you working on another novel?
I have a notebook full of little seedlings that I'm hoping will coalesce into something soon. That's what happened with the farm. It took a year and a half for those seedlings to coalesce, and I just have to have faith it's going to happen again. But right now, nothing specific.
You must be delighted that it's been made into an audiobook, and such a good audiobook. Did you have anything to do with the choosing of the narrator?
I did, Random House, and I really felt strongly that the actress reading the book should be from the Philippines. And so they gave me three different actresses to listen to, and Fran De Leon is the one. I just loved her voice, and I thought that she really captured the book.
I mean, obviously that means that the book reaches a whole audience of people who are print disabled. Do you have any links to blindness within your own family or friends?
I don't. There was, growing up in Wisconsin, one of the other parishioners in our Catholic church was a blind man with a family, so I knew him, but except for that, no.
Well, it is a fantastic book, and let's hope it gives people pause for thought. Joanne Ramos, thank you so much for coming in and being a guest on Read On.
Thank you.
I am looking for Evelyn Arroyo, Jane says to the hairy-looking woman behind the registration desk. I am her cousin. The woman glances up from her computer with an impatient expression that softens into a smile when she sees Amalia in the baby carrier on Jane's chest. How old? She is 4 weeks, Jane answers, pride blooming in her heart. She's a cutie, the woman says, just before a man with a shiny bald head cuts in front of Jane and begins to yell that his wife has been waiting for hours and what the hell is going on. The woman behind the desk tells Jane to go to triage. Jane does not know where this is, but does not ask because the woman is busy with the angry man. Jane walks down a hallway lined with cots. She checks each bed for ate, embarrassed when the man or woman lying there is not asleep, but looks her directly in the eyes. One old man begins to speak to her in Spanish, as if beseeching her for help, and Jane apologizes that she is not a nurse before hurrying away. She finds her cousin farther down the hall. Ate is covered in a sheet, and her face against the softness of the pillow is pinched and hard. Jane realizes she has never seen her cousin asleep before. Even though Jane rents the bunk right above her, Ate is always on the move or away on a job. Her stillness makes Jane fearful. Ate collapsed on a baby nurse assignment in the Fifth Avenue apartment of a family called the Carters. This is what Dina, the Carters' housekeeper, told Jane when they finally spoke. Jane was not entirely surprised by this. Her cousin had been suffering from dizzy spells for several months. Ate blamed them on her blood pressure pills, but did not make time to see a doctor because she was booked in back-to-back jobs. Ate was trying to burp Henry Carter, Dina said, with a hint of accusation in her voice, as if the fault lay with the baby.
Alana Maria narrating The Farm, written by my guest, Joanne Ramos. Out now in print, ebook, and audio. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to hear the books of Ursula Buchan's life, Pen and Ink is a brand new magazine and listings guide promoting diversity and inclusivity in children's publishing. It's been launched by Silip, the Library and Information Association that also runs the annual Carnegie Medal, recognising outstanding books written for children. Issue 1 of Pen and Ink showcases over 450 books from 35 publishers that raise awareness of diversity, including blindness. Broadcaster and writer Connie Huck joined Silip at the launch event and explained why it is so important to have a magazine like Pen and Ink.
I always had a real love of books and I was a fierce reader, but I sort of felt that I was never represented in those books. There were never people like me. And similarly, as with on TV, and it's so easy to feel different, as it were, growing up when everything surrounding you doesn't feel like it includes you. But minorities doesn't just mean ethnic minorities. There are so many different minorities, you know, whether it's to do with a disability or religious background, or whether it's to do with you just love collecting stamps, or, you know, something that marks you out maybe is a bit different from everyone else. Whether you have a stutter or, you know, we're all a minority. Everyone in this room is a minority. And you've all been in situations where you feel other. And it's so important to realise that as minorities, we are all part of a majority. And so it's so important in the books that we read to have diversity and inclusivity and equality.
Rob Green is Pen and Ink's editor, and I began by asking him, what is the magazine's mission?
Well, we had a conversation about 6 months ago about how difficult it was to find books that were diverse and inclusive in one place. And we're from Silip, which is the Library Association of the UK, and we thought, what better place to do it than through Silip? So we set about, from that conversation, to work out how we could do that. And we thought listings and a magazine would be the perfect way to do it, so that people can open up the magazine, can look through it, and they can find the latest books that in some way hit that kind of diversity and inclusion theme that we're going for.
And the response that you got, the 450 titles, 35 publishers, that argues that the publishers are really on board with this.
They really are. And I think we came at it from our own perspective as librarians, and we didn't have the contacts that perhaps some of the other titles like The Bookseller might have, which is a trade magazine aimed squarely at the books industry. So I think having 35 different publishers come on board, 450 titles, as you say, really shows that there was a need for this and people were keen to get on board. And this is our first issue, and in lots of ways it was a way of proving that this concept should work. And we're really hopeful that our next issue, which will be out in September, will have even more publishers and hopefully even more titles, because there is great work going on out there. But sometimes it's under the radar, and we want to give it a platform so that it's really easy to access these kind of books.
And when you open up the magazine, it's not just listings. There are also articles in there as well. Can you describe some of those?
Exactly. We wanted this to be about giving people information on why it's important, and also just how easy it can be to have some inclusive titles. It's aimed at booksellers and bookshops. So we've got articles on the Carnegie and Kate Greenaway medals. We've spoken to Knights Of, which is a great publishing house based down in Brixton, and they've also just opened up a new bookshop, which is full of kind of diverse and inclusive titles. But they show a new way of doing things in that they are approaching all sorts of authors, illustrators. They're covering all sorts of topics. And it really is about diversity and inclusion in the broadest sense of the word. They are diverse from their staff, right the way through to their authors that they choose and work with, through to the books that they're sticking on the shelves. So there's some great work. And we've also talked to some more traditional publishers about what can go on there to be more diverse through, again, it's trying to get these systematic changes so that diversity is not just represented on the bookshelves, but it's also throughout the industry, from the creatives through to the publishers themselves, agents, and all of the sort of steps in between. I think what we want is for those voices just to come to the surface wherever they are in the process of making a book and making a great book.
And it's what Connie Huck was saying in her speech. It's actually demonstrating to people from a very young age that just because you're different doesn't mean that you're excluded, that there are role models out there for you to follow, whether as an author, an illustrator, a publisher, or somebody just working in a bookshop.
Absolutely. I think it's vital that young people especially see these kind of different role models. As you say, that people can succeed in whatever sphere that they want to. So, yes, it's about showing people that they can be an author if they want to, or they can be an illustrator if they want to, but it is also about saying, yes, I could work in the publishing industry. Mm. And these are very much kind of industries that perhaps aren't at the top of people's lists because they don't know too much about them, but I think it's a changing spectrum of who can come into this, and it's about showing people that everyone is welcome.
Absolutely, and that their story matters, that if you're a blind person, you can also find stories about other blind people or written by blind people. Are there any titles about sight loss that stand out for you?
I think we've got The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree by Paola Peretti, which I think is a great book. And this is one area where we're really trying to kind of improve on that kind of accessibility, because I think it's important that when you talk about diversity and inclusion, you're going across the whole spectrum of needs and abilities. And that is something that you can get lost in the BAME areas. But I think looking at disability and different abilities is very, very important. So it's something that we, with Pen and Ink, will definitely try to look at a bit more.
You said that it's not just an industry magazine, it's not just for the trade. It's also accessible for the general public to look at. Can you tell us how we can access it?
Absolutely. We've got our website, which is www.silip.org.uk/pen-and-ink, and it's spelled I-N-C at the end, not I-N-K.
And if one of our listeners wanted to email you with the best book that they'd come across about sight loss, which might not have been listed in Pen and Ink, could they contact you with that?
They absolutely could, yeah. So my email is rob.green@silip.org.uk, and I'm the editor. And they can also get in touch through Twitter, which I think is a great way for people to share those books with other people, because we've got quite a few followers on there. We'd like more. But if they can share any great books at Pen and Ink Books, then that would be a really good way of getting in touch with us and also sharing them with the wider public.
Fantastic. And of course, they can always go down to their local library and ask their librarians for advice.
Absolutely. Libraries are a great way of discovering new books, new authors, and all the sorts of things that you expect from your librarian, they'll be able to help you with.
And Silip isn't just responsible for Pen and Ink, but you also run the Carnegie Medal and Kate Greenaway Prizes.
Exactly, yeah. These are the two oldest children's book medals in the UK. The Carnegie is for authors and the Kate Greenaway is for illustrators. And that shortlist is out at the moment. I think the winners will be announced in June. But I know RNIB also do some great work with us there, because we let you have our shortlist slightly ahead of time so you can do your magic in creating large print format books and braille print books so that you make this shortlist accessible to everyone. And that's really good because we have the shadowing scheme which allows children across the country to take part and actually act as the judges. And this year as well, there is the Shadowers' Choice Scheme, so anyone taking part in that will actually have a vote, which will then go on to be a prize for both the Carnegie and the Kate Greenaway medals.
I know that New College Worcester is very much involved in that shadowing scheme, and that they really relish getting hold of that shortlist every year and reading every single word.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of children out there that feel exactly the same way. These are great awards, and we always have really great entries, whether it's the shortlist, the long list, or the winners themselves.
It's always one of the high points of my year, interviewing the authors for Read On.
I can imagine.
Well, Rob Green, editor of Pen and Ink, thank you so much for introducing us to a magazine that I think fills a really important gap for those of us who want to find out more about inclusive and diverse books.
Thanks for having us, and watch out for the next issue, which will be hopefully hitting digital in September and doorsteps as well that time.
I felt bad about wasting her time. She had been nice bringing up my glasses, but I didn't want to come down because the day before, Dr. Olga had said I had a bad thing in my eyes and I was frightened. I felt better in the tree. Nothing could happen to me here. I told the lady this. I also explained that I couldn't see very well, and it was going to get worse. I said that I didn't want not to be able to climb the tree anymore. She had enormous eyes rimmed with black. If there are things you can't do anymore, you must write list. That way you'll not forget anything. A list? Of course, list. I make lists too, years ago. Could you not see well either? No, it wasn't that. What was wrong then? The lady sighed and set off back down the tree. I had less problem than now. You pain in neck. I followed her gingerly, edging along my branch. I was a bit miffed at what she'd said, but I was also curious. What was on your list? Come down. I show you. What's your name?
Mafalda. And yours?
Estella.
Estella jumped down from the bottom branch of the cherry tree and turned to face me. I'd reached the lower branches and had also jumped. She caught me mid-air and placed me firmly on the ground. Then she walked over to the main entrance of the school, but not before she held out her hand and called my name.
Mafalda. Estella does not tell lies, only truth. We go see Estella's list.
Rosie Ackerman narrating The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree, written by Paola Peretti, which is TB 24549. And to find out more about The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree, and for an interview with Paola Peretti, Rosie Ackerman and the book's translator, just go to our podcast page and type in The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree. Thanks to Rob Green. Is there a book that you think changes the way that we view disability? Or perhaps you found a book in the RNIB library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now it's back to Ursula Buchan for the books of her life. Ursula, was there a book that you read as a young woman or a child that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Well, even as a small child, I was a very, very keen reader. My brothers taught me to read long before I went to school. But I think as far as my decision to become a writer is concerned, I think I date it from reading the first John Buchan thriller that I ever read, which wasn't The 39 Steps. It was The Three Hostages, which is a post-Great War thriller. And the first page is a Richard Hannay, who we know about from The 39 Steps and Greenmantle and Mr. Standfast. This is the fourth in the canon. It's after the war, he's married, he's very happy, he's vegetating in Oxfordshire. He lives in a place called Foss Manor, which is obviously Elsfield Manor. And he writes about walking through the paddock up a grass field up to his house in March, and he describes the hedgerows, and he describes the flowers and the birds and everything he sees. And I was brought up about 20 miles away from Elsfield, and this was the Oxfordshire I knew as well, in the late 50s, early 60s. And it struck me very forcibly that this was something that really appealed to me, the idea of describing a natural scene in such beautiful, fluent prose was an ideal to strive for. And so I think that probably is when I began to think that I would have a crack at it as well.
I can speak about it frankly here, for you two are almost the only completely sane people I know. Well, as a pathologist, I'm fairly staggered. I hardly meet a soul who hasn't some slight kink in his brain as a consequence of the last 7 years. With most people, it's rather a pleasant kink. They're less settled in their grooves, and they see the comic side of things quicker and are readier for adventure. But with some, it's pucker madness. And that means crime. Now, how are you going to write detective stories about that kind of world on the old lines? You can take nothing for granted, as you once could, and your argus-eyed, lightning-brained expert has nothing solid with which to build his foundations. I observed that the poor old war seemed to be getting blamed for a good deal that I was taught in my childhood was due to original sin. Oh, I'm not questioning your Calvinism. Original sin's always there. But the meaning of civilization was that we'd got it battened down under hatches, whereas now it's getting its head up. But it isn't only sin. It's a dislocation of the mechanism of human reasoning, a general loosening of screws. Oddly enough, in spite of parrot talk about shell shock, the men who fought suffer less from it on the whole than other people. The classes that shirt the war are the worst. You see it in Ireland. Every doctor nowadays has to be a bit of a mental pathologist. As I say, you can hardly take anything for granted, and if you want detective stories that are not childish fantasy, you'll have to invent a new kind.
The Three Hostages, written by John Buchan and narrated by Edmund Dane, is TB9738. It's also available in Braille and Giant Print. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I must say that I have something approaching a passion for the Regency novels of Georgette Heyer. I don't know whether they're on audiobook. I very much hope they are. And really, I don't mind which I read on a rainy day when I can't go out into the garden. But Arabella or Frederica or Regency Buck, they all have a great attraction to me because there's such a sense of Georgette Heyer understanding the world that she's writing about. The plots are very fast-moving. Characters are often very finely drawn and not at all sort of caricatures. But it's really that sense she had of she understood the language, the slang, the argot, and the clothes and what the houses look like. They're just an absolute joy, and I read them and reread them.
The schoolroom in the parsonage at Heythrum was not a large apartment, but on a bleak January day, in a household where the consumption of coals was a consideration, this was not felt by its occupants to be a disadvantage. Quite a modest fire in the high barred grate made it unnecessary for all but one of the four young ladies present to huddle shawls round their shoulders. But Elizabeth, the youngest of the Reverend Henry Tallant's handsome daughters, was suffering from the earache. And besides stuffing a roasted onion into the afflicted orifice, had swathed her head and neck in an old cashmere shawl. She lay curled up on an aged sofa, with her head on a worn red cushion, and from time to time uttered a long-suffering sigh, to which none of her sisters paid any heed. Betsy was known to be sickly. It was thought that the climate of Yorkshire did not agree with her constitution, and since she spent the greater part of the winter suffering from a variety of minor ills, her delicacy was regarded by all but her mamma as a commonplace.
Gretel Davis narrating Arabella by Georgette Heyer, which is TB8608. It's also available in Braille. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, I recently read Transcription by Kate Atkinson, and she's a novelist I like very much. She's hard to categorise. You know, her novels aren't all the same kind, but ever since Scenes Behind the Museum, I've been a real fan. And Transcription is I think it came out last year, and I've recently read it. And I did enjoy it very much. It's about a tale about a woman whose job is to listen in to MI5 operators talking to British fascists and Nazis during the Second World War. They don't know, of course, these fascists and Nazis don't know that they're talking to MI5 people, but they are. And the main character of the book is the woman who types the transcripts. And it's a book about truth and lies and how things catch up with you. Though it's essentially tragic, really. She has such a wry sense of humour, Kate Atkinson, and a capacity for bringing out the sort of foibles of people in a very sort of light and clever, deft way. So I enjoyed it very much.
Miss Armstrong? Miss Armstrong, can you hear me?
She could, although she didn't seem able to respond. She was badly damaged, broken. She had been hit by a car. It might have been her own fault. She had been distracted. She had lived for so long abroad that she had probably looked the wrong way when she was crossing Wigmore Street in the midsummer twilight, between the darkness and the daylight.
Miss Armstrong?
A policeman? Or a paramedic? Someone official. Someone who must have looked in her bag and found something with her name on it. She had been at a concert. Shostakovich. The string quartets, all 15, passed out in servings of 3 a day at the Wigmore Hall. It was Wednesday, the 7th, 8th, and 9th. She supposed she would miss the rest of them now.
Miss Armstrong?
In the June of 1942, she had been in the Royal Albert Hall for the concert premiere of the 7th Symphony, the Leningrad. A man she knew had finessed a ticket for her. The hall had been packed to the rafters, and the atmosphere had been electrifying, magnificent. It had felt as though they were at one with the occupants of the siege. And with Shostakovich, too. A collective swelling of the heart. So long ago, so meaningless now.
Transcription by Kate Atkinson is available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library and commercially in print, ebook, and audio, which is narrated by Fenella Woolgar. Ursula Buchan, thank you so much for sharing your great love of reading with the Read On listeners.
Thank you very much.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address. readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.